Ryan Seacrest here. So every great barbecue takes a little patience. And while the food does its thing, you can enjoy a little Chumba Casino. The perfect recipe. Chumba Casino. Always good to have you back.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
This week, the Lindsey Clancy trial reaches some of its most difficult and some of its most important testimony yet. Jurors hear the heartbreaking details of the autopsies of Lindsey's three children. Testimony that was so emotional that questioning had to stop and the courtroom had to be cleared more than once. Then, the focus shifts to Lindsey herself. The people who interacted with her in the weeks and days before January 24th take the stand, describing what they saw and, just as importantly, what they didn't see as Lindsey continued going through the motions of her everyday life. And finally, we get to the heart of this case, Lindsey's mental health. The prosecution begins calling the medical professionals who treated her in the months and weeks leading up to the deaths of her children. And through their testimony, we begin reconstructing what Lindsey was reporting and the medication she was taking, what her doctors believed was happening to her, and whether there were warning signs that something much more serious was unfolding. This week, I went back and put all of it together. Every appointment, every medication change, every symptom she reported, and every new level of care that she sought. Because when you stop looking at each appointment in isolation and put the entire timeline together, there are a few patterns that begin to emerge, and I think they're going to be very important. This week, we're breaking down days 8 through 12 of a trial that has people across the country watching, talking, and fiercely debating what they believe really happened with Lindsey Clancy. This is the 13th Juror Podcast, where we unravel complex court cases, investigations, and true crime stories, from high-profile trials to the mysteries that still leave questions unanswered. We examine the facts, weigh the evidence, and explore the arguments shaping each story, just as the jurors do. I'm your host, Brandi Churchwell. Today's episode is The Commonwealth of Massachusetts versus Lindsey Clancy, The Trial. Part 3. Up until this point, much of the prosecution's case has been focused on what happened on January 24th. But this week, the focus begins to shift to a much more complicated question. What was happening with Lindsey in the months leading up to that night? Was there anything about her behavior that suggested that something was seriously wrong? Were there warning signs? And if there were, could the people around her actually see them? To begin answering those questions, prosecutors called the people who had interacted with Lindsey and the children during their everyday lives. Family members, friends, teachers, childcare workers, and others who saw them in the months, weeks, and even days before everything changed. And what emerged wasn't necessarily the picture of someone who was obviously unraveling. For some witnesses, there was nothing particularly alarming to report. The Clancy's pediatrician described the children as happy and healthy and described Lindsey as a doting mother. A childcare worker at the gym where Patrick and Lindsey worked out said that they would drop Cora and Dawson off and they would go exercise, and then the children were always happy to see them when they came back. Other witnesses did notice subtle changes. Patrick's father remembered Lindsey being unusually quiet around Thanksgiving. At times, she seemed nervous or distracted and would stare off into the distance. But then, she would re-engage and interact completely normally. Around Christmas, she was still quieter than usual, but seemed to be in okay spirits. And that quietness continued into January. On January 22nd, just 2 days before the children were killed, Patrick and Lindsey went to a get-together at a friend's house. One of Patrick's friends remembered Lindsey being quieter than normal there, too. The jury also heard about some changes involving the children. Cora's preschool teacher remembered that Cora wasn't feeling well on January 23rd. Lindsey brought those concerns to the pediatrician the following day, and the pediatrician recommended Children's Miralax, the medication that Patrick would later leave the house to go pick up at CVS on the night that the children were killed. That teacher remembered something else, too. Earlier that January, when Lindsay was hospitalized for several days, Cora told her teachers that she missed her mom. Dawson's teacher noticed a change beginning a little bit earlier. Around October, drop-offs suddenly became more difficult. Dawson became clingier and would cry when Lindsay left, something that his teacher said was unusual for him. Patrick's father also remembered an occasion around Thanksgiving when Lindsay became frustrated because Dawson wasn't listening. And prosecutors even introduced a Facebook post that Lindsay had written in an attachment parenting group about a year and a half earlier, expressing frustration with some of Dawson's behavior. She describes him as difficult and says that every single thing with him is a battle. Now, to be fair, Dawson wasn't even 2 years old at the time that Lindsay posted this. And any boy mom who has a strong-willed 19-month-old can probably relate to her post. But prosecutors wanted to show that Lindsay was capable of being frustrated with her children. But with every witness that took the stand, there was remarkable consistency on one point. Because despite those moments of frustration, and despite the subtle changes that some witnesses noticed, witness after witness described Lindsay as a loving, attentive, and devoted mother. Reddington asked Patrick's father directly how he viewed Lindsay as a mother.
She was very, very good. She fed them great. She did a lot of things with them. They did like the all-American family.
And even all of these witnesses called by the prosecution echoed that same sentiment.
She was just a very loving mother who cared about her children.
I always thought she was a good mom. She loved her kids. She was warm, kind, consistent, loving.
Lindsay was a very loving, caring mother. This is exactly what she wanted to have met. She wanted a big family. She was happy to have her children close in age.
So that brings us right back to the question at the center of this case. If everyone seems to agree that Lindsay loved these children, what happened? Because while people around Lindsay were still seeing a mother who cared deeply for her children, the people that she was confiding in were beginning to hear about something different happening beneath the surface. Patrick's father knew that Lindsay was struggling. She wasn't sleeping, she didn't feel well, and Patrick had confided in him about his concerns over Lindsay's health. In November, Lindsay told a coworker and friend that she didn't believe that she was in a good enough mental state to return to work. Lindsay was a nurse. She was responsible for caring for other people, and she didn't feel capable of doing that yet. She talked about insomnia, brain fog, not feeling like herself. And she told her friend that things had gotten bad enough that she had gone to the emergency department looking for help. Another friend heard similar concerns. Lindsay talked about the insomnia that she had experienced since Callan was born, the anxiety that she was struggling with, and how difficult it had become to figure out what was happening to her. But something really stood out to me about the testimony from Lindsay's friends. They didn't describe someone who had given up. If anything, they described someone who seemed determined to get better. There was always another plan. She was seeing psychiatrists. She was talking about different treatment programs. She tried different medications, desperately searching for something that would allow her to sleep at night without leaving her unable to function during the day. And that balance was becoming increasingly difficult to find. Lindsay told her friends about negative side effects from the medications. She would stop one and then try another, looking for something that worked. She described the entire process as long and difficult. And by January, she still wasn't getting any better. She told friends that she felt like a zombie. And then, just days before the children died, Lindsay confided in her lifelong best friend that something wasn't right.
She had shared that she had been taking a medication that caused her to have some dark thoughts, but that she was going to, or had been weaning, like tapering off that medication and was trialing new ones that would remove those side effects and be more helpful and therapeutic to what she needed.
And did she tell you what those dark thoughts were?
No.
Her friend testified that Lindsay never told her that she wanted to hurt herself, and she never said she wanted to hurt the children. She said she was having dark thoughts. And yet, the people closest to Lindsay remained hopeful, largely because Lindsay herself still seemed hopeful. Whenever she talked about what she was going through, she always talked about what she was going to do next. There was another appointment, or another trial medication, or another program, another attempt to get better. And I think that's an important piece of the picture that we're beginning to see. Because from the outside, Lindsay could still function. She could go to the gym, spend time with friends, take her children to school, and bring Cora to the pediatrician. But privately, she was also telling people that she couldn't sleep, couldn't think clearly, didn't feel like herself, and was desperately trying to find something that would make her feel better. But friends and family could only tell the jury what they saw from the outside, and what Lindsay chose to tell them. To understand what was happening clinically, we have to go one layer deeper. And that's where this trial now goes. Because next, the prosecution begins calling the people that Lindsay actually turned to for help. The psychiatrists, therapists, nurse practitioners, and other medical professionals who evaluated her, prescribed her medications, documented her symptoms, and made decisions about her care. And when you put their records together chronologically, a much more detailed picture begins to emerge of what was happening to Lindsay Clancy in the months leading up to January 24th. We'll be right back.
Hey guys, it's Ryan. I want to tell you about my new pastime, Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has been around for over a decade, delivering the most fun you can have online. Play social casino-style games for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
The treatment Lindsay Clancy received has taken center stage in this trial, and for good reason. At the heart of this case is not just what happened on January 24th or what happened in the months leading up to it, but it's why. There's no dispute that Lindsay spent months seeking help. She saw multiple providers, tried different medications, changed medications, and eventually sought more intensive psychiatric care. But the prosecution and defense have two very different explanations for what that history means. Prosecutors appear to be painting Lindsay as someone searching for a quick fix, jumping from doctor to doctor, trying medication after medication, and sometimes not even taking what she was prescribed. In their version of events, the constant changes weren't evidence of a worsening illness. They were evidence that Lindsay was never fully committed to the treatment being offered. The defense sees that exact same history very differently. They say that Lindsay was becoming progressively sicker while desperately trying to find someone who could help her. Their argument is that as she moved between providers, medications, and levels of care, no one ever really stepped back and put the entire picture together. No one adequately reconstructed her history or coordinated her care or recognized the emerging pattern or reconsidered whether the original diagnosis of depression and anxiety was wrong. And according to the defense, that failure is the core of what went wrong here. They say that Lindsay was actually suffering from bipolar disorder with postpartum onset that was progressing toward psychosis, while her providers failed to recognize it, and the treatment that she received only made her underlying condition worse. So, what does this timeline actually show? A woman doctor shopping for the answer that she wanted? Or a woman in a deteriorating psychiatric crisis, repeatedly asking for help from a medical system that failed to recognize what was happening? Now, that's ultimately for the jury to decide. But to understand that decision, you have to see the entire sequence of events. So I went through this week's testimony and put that timeline together. So here's the thing, y'all. If you've listened to 13th Juror for a while, or watched a trial with me, or followed me on social media, then y'all already know I love a timeline. And I'm not talking about a little bullet point timeline. I want the details, I want every date, every time, every appointment, every medication, every piece of information that we get laid out together, because that's when you can start to see the bigger picture. And in this case, it's a lot, y'all. Lindsay had appointments with psychiatrists, therapists, multiple nurse practitioners, emergency room visits, even an inpatient psychiatric treatment. And on top of that, there's medications. Lots of them. But when you put it all together, then take a step back and look at the big picture, you start to get a better idea of just what we're looking at. And in this case, there was a lot to put together. Now, when you hear all of those things one at a time, spread out over weeks of testimony, it can be really hard to keep track of what happened when, who was treating her, and what changed along the way. But when you put all of it together in one timeline and then take a look, I think that Lindsay's treatment really breaks pretty naturally into three distinct phases, and each one tells us something different about how she got from September of 2022 to January 24th of 2023. And the first phase is actually pretty simple. So the first phase is the one where Lindsay's primary mental health care provider was psychiatrist Dr. Jennifer Tufts. Around mid-September, Lindsay knew that she was struggling with her mental health. She was reporting anxiety, trouble sleeping, racing thoughts, decreased appetite, and difficulty functioning. She searched online and found a psychiatrist named Dr. Jennifer Tufts, who specialized in postpartum depression. So, Lindsay scheduled a telehealth appointment for 3 days later. Lindsay also completed the Edinburgh Postnatal Depression Scale, a screening tool commonly used to identify symptoms of postpartum depression. She scored a 23, a score that indicates severe depressive symptoms. Lindsay's first appointment with Dr. Tufts was on September 15th and lasted just under an hour. Dr. Tufts diagnosed her with generalized anxiety disorder and adjustment disorder with depressed mood. She recommended therapy and prescribed the antidepressant Zoloft. But Lindsay was still breastfeeding, and she was also really hesitant about taking medication. She especially didn't want to start one while she was nursing, so although she filled the prescription, she didn't take it yet. Over the next 4 weeks, Lindsay had a couple more appointments with Dr. Tufts, and she attended a therapy session with a licensed mental health counselor who worked at the same practice as Dr. Tufts. Lindsay reported feeling a little bit better during one of the appointments. She was at least getting a little bit more sleep. But she still didn't feel like she was ready to return to work yet, so Lindsay worked with Dr. Tufts to complete paperwork requesting an extension of her maternity leave. Lindsay didn't believe that she was ready to take on the responsibility of caring for patients as a nurse, especially while she was still struggling with her sleep. Her anxiety was also beginning to increase again, and she knew she needed to get it under control. Now, during all of this, Lindsay still had not started taking the Zoloft. She was reluctant to use medication. Dr. Tufts documented that Lindsay's anxiety was clinically significant, and she felt Lindsay's reluctance to take the medication showed a lack of insight into the severity of what she was experiencing, an observation that would become a recurring theme in Dr. Tufts' records. By mid-October, as her anxiety and insomnia continued to get worse, Lindsay finally decided to give the Zoloft a try. She said she followed the instructions, low dose for the first week, and then doubling the dose at the start of week two. And that's when Lindsay said things got dramatically worse. She reported severe insomnia, racing thoughts, worsening anxiety, brain fog, and feeling awful. At one point, she had reportedly gone roughly 48 hours without sleeping. She stopped the Zoloft and told Tufts that she was scared by what she had experienced. So, Dr. Tufts prescribed Ativan for severe anxiety. When she followed back up with Dr. Tufts 5 days later, Lindsay said the Ativan was helping a little bit with her anxiety, although she did still feel anxious and depressed, but it wasn't helping her sleep at all. She began using over-the-counter Benadryl for sleep and even tried a THC gummy one night, but nothing was really giving her any relief. So Dr. Tufts doubled the Ativan dosage and prescribed two more anxiety medications for Lindsay to add on. But almost immediately, Lindsay developed a new concern. She didn't want to become addicted to Ativan, and she didn't want to add on more medications. And y'all, I think that this is important when we start talking about all of the medications that Lindsay was ultimately prescribed. During this first phase, Lindsay had 7 appointments with Dr. Tufts and had at least 2 therapy sessions that we know of right now. And during that time, she was prescribed 4 psychiatric medications. She essentially rejected 2 of them, the buspirone and hydroxyzine. She tried the Zoloft briefly and then stopped after her reaction to it. And the medicine that actually she did find helpful, the Ativan, was the one that she was already asking to get off of. By November 2nd, Lindsay and Tufts had developed a plan to slowly taper her off of Ativan. So at this point, this does not look like someone who is asking doctors to pile medication on top of medication. If anything, Lindsay seems to be trying to do the opposite. She wants something to help her sleep and control the anxiety, but she is increasingly worried about what she's taking and doesn't want medication to become the long-term answer. But the problem is that she isn't getting any better. And before the Ativan taper can really solve anything, Lindsay's insomnia and anxiety become severe enough that on November 16th, she goes to the emergency department looking for help. And that's where phase two begins. We'll be right back.
Looking for a little Hollywood-style fun? Check out Ryan Seacrest's 10K Ways exclusively at Chumba Casino. There's 10,000 ways to play. Get spinning for free at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
This is the phase where Lindsay's primary mental health care provider becomes South Shore's Perinatal Behavioral Health Program, a program specifically designed for women experiencing mental health problems during pregnancy and postpartum. And this is where the timeline becomes much more complicated. After that emergency room visit, Lindsay is connected with the program and initially begins working with nurse practitioner Julie Paul. But Julie is in the process of leaving the practice to move out of state, so she only meets with Lindsay twice. And by the time Lindsay gets to Julie on November 21st, her symptoms have gotten significantly worse. During that intake, Julie notes that Lindsay scores extremely high on the Edinburgh screening, as well as a 21 out of 21 on the Generalized Anxiety Depression Scale. Lindsay reports many of the same symptoms that she had already been struggling with: insomnia, racing thoughts, and feeling overwhelmed. Julie comes up with a treatment plan. She has Lindsay continue taking Ativan because it had been helping with anxiety. She gets her set up with a clinician there for therapy and schedules that appointment for the following week. And because Lindsay had briefly taken Prozac during nursing school and remembered it working, Julie decides to try that again. She starts Lindsay on a low dose for 4 days and schedules a follow-up to see how she responds. But once again, Lindsay reports problems. Her insomnia gets worse. She feels spacey and out of it. And after only 4 days, she wants to stop taking Prozac. Over the next 3 weeks, the medication plan starts changing rapidly. On Friday, November 25th, Julie takes Lindsay off of Prozac, gives her Klonopin as needed to replace the Ativan, and adds an antidepressant called Remeron. She also gives her a one-time dose of Ambien to help her sleep. The next day, Lindsay reports sleeping better, so they increase the Remeron. On Sunday, she says she slept well again, but now she feels disconnected from herself and from reality. Lindsay thinks that the Klonopin is causing it, so she doesn't want to take that anymore. By Monday, things are getting worse. She's reporting a panic attack, dissociation, and confusion. Julie suggests that Lindsay take an Ativan, since that had worked for her before, and recommends that she go for a run. But she also recommends a partial hospitalization program, because at this point, she believes that Lindsay's symptoms are severe enough to require a higher level of care. And then, Julie leaves the practice. Lindsay's medication management transfers to Rebecca Gelada, and this is where things really escalate. On November 29th, Lindsay is still severely anxious and barely sleeping. Gelada continues the Remeron. Then Seroquel is added. Lindsay wants off Remeron. Prozac comes back into the plan. Ativan comes back. Seroquel is increased. Then Valium enters the picture. And all the while, Lindsay keeps reporting that something is wrong. Her thoughts are becoming darker. Her depression is worsening. She feels numb. She says she feels like she's going to die, and she doesn't care. And she begins describing intrusive thoughts. Her screening scores are getting worse too. Her Edinburgh score rises from 17 to 21, while her GAD score rises from 14 to 19. But here's what really stood out to me when I built this timeline. At the exact same time that the medications are becoming more complicated, Lindsay is becoming increasingly desperate to get away from them. She asked to stop Remeron. She doesn't want Ativan. She's worried about becoming dependent on Valium. She wants off Seroquel. She questions Prozac. Eventually, she says she wants to get off of everything. And she isn't only telling her prescribers that something's wrong. She's looking for help everywhere. She requests an emergency appointment with her primary care doctor. She goes back to Tufts to talk about the problems that she's having with the medications. She continues therapy with Letitia Dukes. She calls a suicide hotline. She's evaluated by the Aspire crisis team. She tries to get into a higher level of psychiatric care. She pursues the Women and Infants program in Rhode Island. And eventually, she goes back to an emergency department because of suicidal thoughts. So when we talk about Lindsay moving between providers during this period, I think the chronology matters. Because one interpretation is doctor shopping, but another interpretation, and clearly the one the defense is building, is that the treatment wasn't working. Lindsay knew it wasn't working, and she kept looking for someone who could figure out why. By mid-December, Lindsay is reporting suicidal thoughts and saying that she needs a higher level of care. She goes to Mass General Hospital. She pursues the Rhode Island program. And by the end of December, Patrick is calling South Shore because Lindsay now wants to go to McLean Hospital. And this time, she goes. Around the 1st of January, Lindsay voluntarily admits herself for inpatient psychiatric treatment and remains there for several days. And after months of outpatient appointments, emergency visits, therapy, crisis evaluations, and medication changes, you might expect McLean to finally provide the answer that Lindsay had been hoping for. But it doesn't. Providers there diagnose major depressive disorder without psychotic features and insomnia associated with a mental health condition. They don't document psychosis, they don't see mania, and once again, the medications change. Seroquel is tapered, Valium is switched, and within days, Lindsay is discharged home. Which brings us to the final phase. After McLean, Lindsay returns to Dr. Tufts. And what's striking about January is that despite months of treatment and despite an inpatient psychiatric hospitalization, Lindsay still doesn't feel better. She tells Tufts that she's depressed, numb, flat. She said she feels like a zombie. She continues having anxiety, particularly in the mornings, and she's still trying to get off benzodiazepines. And the medication changes continue. Trazodone is increased. Ativan becomes Valium. Then Tufts starts amitriptyline at 10 milligrams. And Lindsay continues looking for answers. She even contacts Tufts about ketamine therapy, telling her that she's desperate for something that might work quickly. Then we get to January 23rd, the day before the children are strangled. Lindsay meets with Tufts again, and she's reported increasing anxiety. Her heart is racing. Her appetite is down. She's lost weight. She has no motivation. She feels numb. She has to force herself to get out of bed and leave the house. But she's sleeping. And she denies wanting to hurt herself or anyone else. Tufts believes that Lindsay is suffering from depression. So the Valium taper is slowed. And the amitriptyline is increased from 10 milligrams to 20. And less than 24 hours later, Cora, Dawson, and Callan are found strangled in the basement of their home. So before we move on, I want to zoom all the way back out because I know that that was a lot. That was a lot of appointments, a lot of medications, a lot of changes in a relatively short amount of time and a lot of information. But when I simplified this timeline, something really stood out to me. Phase one, Lindsay is cautious about medication. Over roughly 2 months with Tufts, she's prescribed four medications. Two of them she essentially doesn't take. She tries one of them briefly and then has a bad reaction and stops it. And then there's Ativan, the one medication that she said actually helped her, but almost immediately she's worried about becoming dependent on it and starts working to develop a plan to taper off of it. So that's phase one. Four prescriptions in roughly 2 months. And Lindsay is already trying to minimize what she's taking. And then we get to phase two. In roughly 3 weeks with South Shore, eight more medications enter the picture. That's twice as many medications in less than half the time. One is only a single dose, but Lindsay tries the others and at one point or another raises concerns about essentially every single medication in the regimen. She reports side effects, she worries about dependence, she asks to stop medications, she wants simpler combinations, and eventually she reaches the point where she says she wants to get off of all of it. And at the same time, her symptoms are not improving, they're escalating. The insomnia continues, the depression gets worse, the intrusive and suicidal thoughts become more prominent. She calls a crisis hotline, seeks emergency care, tries higher levels of treatment, and ultimately ends up hospitalized at McLean. And then there's phase three. Lindsay comes home from McLean and returns to Tufts. And now we're down to the final 2.5 weeks before January 24th, and medication management continues. Trazodone, Ativan, Valium, and finally amitriptyline. But Lindsay still isn't better. She's still depressed, still numb, still anxious, still trying to get off of benzodiazepines. And that brings us to another question that starts to become harder to ignore as you look at this timeline. Why wasn't any of this working? Lindsay was seeking treatment. She was trying medications, going to therapy, doing all the things, right? So despite all of that, she continued to get worse. So was it simply that they had not found the right medication yet? Was she not staying on some of these medications long enough for them to work? Were side effects complicating the picture? Or is it possible that at some point they were treating the wrong thing? Because remember, Lindsay's treatment began with diagnosis of generalized anxiety disorder and adjustment disorder with depressed mood. Over time, depression became a much bigger part of the picture, but the defenses argued that Lindsay's symptoms were actually signs of something much more serious, and one possibility they have repeatedly raised is bipolar disorder. And this week, for the first time, we learned that this wasn't an idea created by the defense after the children died. At least one of Lindsay's providers was questioning whether she could be bipolar while she was actually treating her. That provider was Rebecca Gelada, the psychiatric nurse practitioner who took over Lindsay's care at South Shore's perinatal behavioral health program in late November. And by early December, Gelada was seeing things in Lindsay's presentation that concerned her. Lindsay's anxiety was severe. She was barely sleeping. She described racing thoughts. Her medications weren't producing the improvement that they expected. And on December 7th, Lindsay reported something particularly notable. Even though she hadn't slept, she didn't feel tired. She was also having difficulty concentrating and described her thoughts as racing. And these symptoms caused Gelada to begin questioning whether Lindsay's presentation could fit somewhere on the bipolar spectrum. She had Lindsay complete a bipolar screening questionnaire, and Lindsay did not meet the standard threshold on that screening. But Gelada testified that the result didn't necessarily end her thoughts on this. She said that that screening, or any kind of screening tools like that, they have limitations, and they can miss some presentations, including bipolar 2. And Gelada's concern apparently became significant enough that she actually discussed it with both Lindsay and Patrick. She raised the possibility that what they were seeing could represent a hypomanic or mixed manic state, and she sent Lindsay information about bipolar disorder to review. But according to Gelada, Patrick pushed back on the idea.
I discussed with her and her husband the possibility of potentially an underlying bipolar disorder. I based this on several factors, one of them being that she had such what we call an activating response to the Zoloft. It's unusual for somebody to describe taking Zoloft and then going 48 hours without sleep and not being tired. So that raised my clinical suspicion a bit. And she had been, I would say, having difficulty tolerating other antidepressant medications that we had been trying to have her take since then. And so, again, I'm wondering if it's because potentially there might be an underlying what we call mood disorder, bipolar.
Okay. And when you explain this to them, your thoughts about her reactions to the medication and these reported prior symptoms, did Patrick and Lindsay seem receptive to your diagnosis?
I recall Patrick saying, "My wife is not bipolar." Lindsay looked at me. She did not say anything.
Now, look, I don't think that that statement should automatically be interpreted as Patrick refusing to acknowledge that Lindsay was sick or anything like that. There is still a significant stigma attached to a bipolar diagnosis. And for a family that had entered treatment believing that they were dealing with postpartum anxiety or depression, suddenly hearing bipolar disorder would have been a very different and probably frightening possibility to consider. But from a medical standpoint, that question kind of matters, because if Lindsay actually had an underlying bipolar spectrum disorder, that could fundamentally change how her symptoms were understood and how certain medications were approached. And that is where Jolada's testimony becomes particularly important, because now, for the first time in this timeline, we have a provider looking at the insomnia, the racing thoughts, the lack of fatigue despite little sleep, the worsening mood, and the unusual response to treatment, and asking, what if this isn't just anxiety and depression? Now, that question has not been resolved yet. Lindsay would later be evaluated at McLean, where providers did not document evidence of mania or psychosis, and they diagnosed her with major depressive disorder without psychotic features. But the fact that Jolada raised bipolar disorder before January 24th gives the defense something important: evidence that at least one treating provider had already begun questioning whether the original diagnostic framework fully explained what was happening to Lindsay. And that opens the door to an even bigger question for this case. If Jolada was right to be concerned about bipolar disorder, what did that mean for the medications that Lindsay was being given? Because that's where this gets even more complicated, and we can expect to hear a lot about that in the coming weeks. Now that we've put Lindsay's treatment timeline together, I want to talk about what happened when the defense got its turn with these providers. Now, I don't think we need to go back through every question that Reddington asked every provider, but I do want to focus on kind of the bigger picture. What was the defense trying to show the jury through these witnesses? And there was one theme that came up again and again. Did anyone treating Lindsay ever have the whole picture? Because by November and December, there were a lot of people involved in Lindsay's care. But these people weren't necessarily all talking to each other. And Dr. Jennifer Tufts may be the best example of that. Tufts had one of the longest relationships with Lindsay because she began treating her in September, and she was still treating her on January 23rd, the day before the children were killed. But Reddington established on Cross that every single one of those appointments happened through telehealth. Tufts never saw Lindsay in person during the 4 months that she treated her. In fact, the first time that she ever saw Lindsay face-to-face was in the courtroom. Now look, I'm the first person to admit I love a telehealth appointment. Anything that keeps me from having to drive across town, find parking, and sit in a waiting room is perfectly fine by me. But Reddington made an important point on Cross. There are things that a camera just cannot show you. You might not see someone wringing their hands below the screen, or constantly bouncing their leg, or pacing, or displaying other physical signs of anxiety or agitation that can give a provider additional insight into the patient's mental state. Think about it like this. Tufts wrote 13 prescriptions for 7 different medications, strong medications, for someone that she had never seen beyond a computer screen. These appointments were listed as 17 minutes each. Now, Tufts says that they were actually a total of 25-ish, but either way, that's a short amount of time when you're on a computer screen and can't see how their behavior is in person, and you don't have their previous medical history, and you aren't communicating with the other providers, and yet you're writing 13 prescriptions for 7 different medications during those months. It's a little bit scary, right? And Reddington also spent a lot of time on Tufts' experience. When Lindsay first became her patient, Tufts had only recently finished her residency and had been practicing independently for a month. She had experience with postpartum patients during her training, and she had listed maternal and perinatal mental health as an area of interest. But Reddington clearly wanted the jury questioning whether her experience matched the complexity of Lindsay. So, especially on a computer screen. So then he got into something that I think is very important. Tufts never obtained all of Lindsay's outside psychiatric records. As Lindsay began moving into other levels of care, Tufts largely just relied on Lindsay to tell her what was happening. She could have requested releases to obtain records from other providers and programs that were treating Lindsay, but she testified that she just didn't think it was necessary. And because of that, there were significant pieces of Lindsay's mental health history that Tufts and all the other providers didn't know. Because it's not just Tufts, y'all. All of these providers got on the stand and said the same thing, that they did not pull her full records. Tufts did not know everything about what Lindsay was reporting to the other providers. And she didn't know that Lindsay had contacted a suicide hotline twice. And when Reddington told her that on cross, Tufts admitted that that surprised her. And this is where Reddington began doing something pretty effective, I think. He would give these providers information that they didn't have at the time and then ask whether that information would have mattered. For example, Tufts asked if she had known that Lindsay had said she was having thoughts of harming the children. That would have been very concerning, and that could have changed what she did. Now, obviously, that doesn't mean that Tufts should have somehow known something that Lindsay never told her, but it does expose a limitation in one of the prosecution's most important arguments. Because when a provider says, "I didn't believe Lindsay was dangerous," Reddington wants the jury to be like, "Yeah, based on what information?" And that theme, like I said, extended beyond Tufts. Different providers were getting different pieces of Lindsay. Her therapist might hear one thing, her medication provider might hear something else, an emergency room doctor, you know, saw her during a crisis, McLean evaluated her during a short inpatient hospitalization, and Lindsay herself wasn't necessarily reporting the same exact symptoms to every single person she saw. Her symptoms fluctuated. So the argument here isn't necessarily that every one of these providers failed Lindsay. It's just that their individual assessments may only be as complete as the information that they had. And how effective can fragmented care really be? I expect we'll hear a lot more about this in the defense's case in chief. We'll be right back.
How to have fun anytime, anywhere. Step one, go to ChumbaCasino.com.
ChumbaCasino.com. Got it.
Step two, collect your welcome bonus.
Come to Papa, welcome bonus.
Step three, play hundreds of casino-style games for free.
That's a lot of games, all for free.
Step four, unleash your excitement.
Chumba. Chumba Casino has been delivering thrills for over a decade. So claim your free welcome bonus now and live the Chumba life. Visit ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
I want to end this episode by going back to some of the most difficult testimony that we've heard in this trial so far. The autopsies of Cora, Dawson, and Callan. The medical examiner took the stand and walked the jury through the findings from each child's autopsy, including the injuries that they suffered and ultimately the causes and manners of death. Autopsy pictures were also shown to the jury. This was incredibly emotional. Lindsay openly cried as the medical examiner described what happened to her children, and reporters inside the courtroom noted that some of the jurors were visibly affected by this, wiping tears from their eyes, even as the pictures were being displayed. This week, we return to the autopsy evidence again. And this time, it was even more brutal. I have made the decision not to walk you through the details of those injuries. We all know what happened to those children. And because of their ages and the nature of their deaths, I don't think that describing every injury or walking you through those photographs adds anything necessary to your understanding of this case. If you do want to hear that testimony in its entirety, you can find it in the Day 8 and Day 12 coverage of that trial. For our purposes, I think it's enough to understand what the medical examiner established without putting you through the graphic details of exactly what Cora, Dawson, and Callan endured in their final moments. But I do want to talk about what happened during the testimony. Dr. Renee Stonebridge took the stand to testify about the injuries, and almost immediately, it became clear just how difficult this testimony was going to be. Lindsay sat at the defense table, audibly sobbing, at times so uncontrollably that you could hear her crying on the courtroom cameras. Jurors appeared visibly uncomfortable, with some of them reportedly stealing glances over at Lindsay as the testimony continued. Reporting from inside the courtroom also noted that Lindsay's father was crying. Eventually, the judge stopped the testimony and sent the jury out of the courtroom. He then cleared the courtroom entirely to give Lindsay time to regain her composure. About half an hour later, court resumed. Before the testimony continued, the judge addressed the jury and acknowledged that it had been an emotional moment in the courtroom, but he reminded them of something incredibly important. Their decisions have to be based on facts and the law, not emotion. Then another forensic pathologist took the stand to continue discussing the trauma and the autopsy findings, and once again, Lindsay began to cry. Her attorney, Kevin Reddington, held her hand at the defense table as the testimony went through the details. You can hear Lindsay sobbing in the background of the courtroom audio, until finally she becomes so overwhelmed that she cries out, "I can't do it."
That occurs beneath it. It can be an imprint, it could be a pattern, or it could be more developed types of injuries such as bruising or abrasions. And what about injuries?
All right, counsel, could... We're going to take a break this time, all right?
Court, all right. Jurors, close your notebooks. Place them on the chairs, please. Just wait for you.
Another break had to be called. I was watching from home, and I had to pause it and walk outside to get myself together. Eventually, the jury returned, and the medical examiner's testimony continued. Pictures were shown, the children's injuries were described in detail, and Lindsay continued to cry throughout it. Reddington objected several times during this portion of the testimony, and he appeared increasingly frustrated as it continued. Eventually, the testimony was completed and court ended around 4 p.m. And I think the judge's instruction to the jury in the middle of all of this is important because emotion is exactly what I want to talk about here. There's something about this part of the prosecution's case that I'm really struggling with. There's no dispute in the courtroom over who killed Cora, Dawson, and Callan. Lindsay has acknowledged that she killed her children. The real question this jury is being asked to decide is whether she has criminal responsibility for what she did. Of course, the prosecution still has the burden of proving its case. They have every right to establish how these children died and present the evidence necessary to prove the charges. But I think there comes a point where we have to ask, how much is necessary? We have now heard hours of incredibly detailed testimony about what happened to these children. We've heard from first responders, emergency room personnel, and multiple medical examiners. Jurors have been shown heartbreaking photographs. We've heard of them wiping tears from their eyes. We've watched Lindsay become so overwhelmed that court had to stop. And I keep coming back to the same question. What does more and more and more of this actually prove about the issue that this jury has to decide? Evidence involving the deaths of three very young children is inherently emotional. There's no way for jurors to hear and see these things without being affected by them. Hell, I was affected by them and I watched from home. And when the underlying fact that Lindsay killed her children is not in dispute, I feel like repeatedly presenting the most devastating details risks shifting the jury's focus from the legal question before them to an emotional response to the horror of what happened. And I think the prosecution knows that. And beyond the legal issue, I keep thinking about Cora, Dawson, and Callan. Those cute little faces in the pictures. Their lives were so much more than the manner in which they died. At some point, repeatedly displaying and describing the most intimate and horrific details of their deaths doesn't feel like honoring them to me. It feels like victimizing them all over again. I understand that some of this evidence has to be presented. I just don't believe that because evidence can be introduced, That means every single painful detail needs to be. The jury knows what happened. The question they ultimately have to answer is why and what was happening in Lindsey Clancy's mind when it did. I don't envy this jury. I can't imagine what those deliberations will be like. But whatever they ultimately decide about Lindsey Clancy, there's one part of this case that isn't complicated. Cora, Dawson, and Callan were three beautiful little kids who should still be here. And whatever verdict eventually comes back in this courtroom, that part will never change. My name is Brandi Churchwell, creator and host of the 13th Juror podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure to follow the show on your favorite podcast platform and leave a rating or review. It helps more listeners discover the podcast. And if you know someone who would find this case as fascinating as you did, share this episode with them. For additional episodes, case updates, and more information about the podcast, visit our website at 13thjurorpodcast.com. The evidence has been presented, the arguments have been made, and now comes the same question faced by every juror. What do you believe? Thank you for listening.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.